Thanks. It's a pleasure to be back. As some of you know, I see some familiar faces out there. I was here a couple of weeks ago during the tutorial week, but there are a lot of new people out there too. This is actually going to be really fun, I think, this week. There's a number of speakers who are coming who are sort of pioneers or leaders in the field of RNA structure prediction from based on thermodynamic principles, RNA evolution, also some experimental biologists who pioneered some of the methods, and so we'll learn a lot about that during the coming week. I also saw that last week there was a brief tutorial on RNA structure, so I'm presuming everybody has gotten background information, but I won't delve into that. But at any point, if something's not clear, just interrupt me and we can stop and we can try to explain something, or we can get a discussion going or whatever. What I'm going to talk about is work that we've been doing on a particular method for predicting RNA structure called comparative method, or sometimes called phylogenetic method. A couple of the points I want to get across is the way that it's usually approached is it's not really done as a phylogenetic method, but one of our interests has been in making it really phylogenetic as opposed to just comparative. I'll say right at the beginning, this has actually been a joint work with myself. I had a graduate student in the applied math department in Boulder, Colorado, where I was until a year and a half ago, who did almost all the programming I'm going to talk about, and Alan Lapides, who's a physicist at the Santa Fe Institute in Los Alamos National Labs, and he's applied similar kinds of things that I'm going to talk about today to RNA, to protein structure prediction, where the problem is actually more difficult, but some of the same principles can pertain. The basic idea behind comparative methods, I could give you all an introduction to it, and you would understand the basic idea in about 5 minutes, because it's really quite simple. What I hope to do today is, in fact, show you that, yes, the basic idea is simple, but there are a number of subtleties that one can take advantage of to hopefully improve the sensitivity of the method, and we've been able to do that, I think, and then also point out some open problems that we're still working on, we haven't completely solved yet. So the basic premise of the idea is if I have a collection of RNA sequences that have the same function, I know that maybe they're the same ribosomal RNA in a whole bunch of different species or something, so they all perform essentially the same function, I can usually assume with high confidence that they have approximately the same structure, maybe not precisely the same structure, but very similar structure. And so the goal is to just simply find the structure that all of these different molecules can fold up into. There might be more than one, and if there are, I'd like to sort of get the repertoire of what those structures are. You could also think of this as essentially creating a structural alignment. The last couple of weeks have been mostly about alignment methods. So the idea is you're going to take proteins or RNA or DNA, whatever, that have a common function, and you're going to line them up and get some notion of where they're conserved and to what extent and so on. We're going to do the same thing here, except now inherent in the alignment we're looking at is information about the structure of the molecule. This is actually the oldest method for predicting RNA structure. Here's a picture from 1965, a paper by Holley et al., in which the first tRNA sequence was determined. This tRNA sequence is, I don't know, about 75 nucleotides long or so. So there are three different structures shown here. It's all the same sequence if you read it from one end to the next. It's the same sequence, and the point is they didn't know what the structure was, and they were trying to predict what the structure was just based on the sequence. Everybody, you know, knew the base pairing rules, AU, GC, base pairs, and so on. And so they came up with three different structures. See, I left out a little bit here. There's supposed to be a little loop there that got left off the copy of the Xeroxing. Anyway. They didn't know what the structure was. They looked at these and they all seemed plausible in the sense that they had a fair amount of base pairing. Each one has about the same number of base pairs that are formed. At the time, in 1965, there weren't even the thermodynamic parameters that people have nowadays in order to ascertain which ones are more likely to have a energy minimum and so on. So they published all three structures as plausible structures for the tRNA. A year later, the same group determined the sequence of a second tRNA molecule, and voila, now there's only one structure that both RNAs can fold up into. Again, the structures aren't completely identical, but they have the same overall flavor. This is the cloverleaf structure that I'm sure you've come across, famous structure in biology. That was the only structure, at least of the ones that they considered plausible in their first analysis,
that all of the, that both of the two RNAs could fold up into. Now it turns out that the same year that they did their second tRNA, two more RNAs were also sequenced by two different groups. So now there were four RNAs, and it turns out they all could fold up into the same cloverleaf structure. So voila, proof that RNAs fold up into cloverleaf structures. Yeah, this is, you know, the extrapolation 1, 2, 3, infinity kind of thing. Actually, they extrapolated from 2 to infinity, but it turns out to be right, in fact, with some exceptions. That is, there are certain parts of there are certain tRNAs that through evolution have lost or gained parts of these structures, but overall the structure is the same. Yeah.
Gary, the stuff sticking out the end on the left, is that stuff significant? The stuff sticking out.
Are you talking about this stuff up here?
Oh,
these, what, and so they end up with these different things you can put together. Each one of these structures has at least 3 or 4 nucleotides in a row that are complementary, and so you can imagine those forming base pairs, and then you have to kind of zipper it up and imagine what's happening in between. And as I said, for a molecule as short as the tRNA, you end up with a fairly limited number of possible structures by just starting with the, assuming that at least some of the helices have to be at least 3 or 4 nucleotides long. If you were to start with a bigger molecule, and this one is about just over 300 nucleotides, and you just make a list of all the 4 long complementary regions of the sequence, you end up with a huge number of possible base pairing regions. If you were to try to take this information and predict what the structure of this RNA was, you'd be in a lot of trouble. There's just too many combinations, many of which are mutually exclusive. What's that? This is not a contact map. This is I just pulled this figure out, and let me explain what it is. It's just a section of an RNA virus. It's about 300 nucleotides long, from 1800 to 2100. It was known for a variety of reasons that this particular region of the virus RNA had an interesting structure. So a long time ago, they were trying to decide if they could predict what the structure of this region was. So they did sort of what you did in the tRNA. They just simply looked, let's ask for all the nucleotide stretches of at least 3 nucleotides long in which I have a complementary region, and then you just plot them all on here. So what's being shown here is that there's a 3 nucleotide stretch here, which is complementary to the 3 nucleotide stretch there. And if I just plot all the potential secondary structures of at least 3 nucleotides in a row, it just ends up being a mess like this. Yeah. Just as sort of a minimum, if I went to 2, it would be even shorter. If I went to 4, it would be somewhat longer. But, it might be more useful, except that, in fact, if I went to 5, you know, then it would, you know, you can just look at these, that the longest stretches, I could get rid of the shorter and shorter ones and just be left with the long ones. The problem is I'm probably now missing part of the real structure. In fact, some of the actual helices that are part of the structure are, in fact, quite short, and that's not unusual. So the point of this figure is just to show that if you start looking at molecules that have even a reasonable length, like 300 or so nucleotides, you quickly run out to the point where you can't sort of enumerate all the possible helices because they simply get too big too fast. Yeah, Peter.
Excuse me, Gary. That would be quite the nature argument where you search for stretches of a certain length and longer.
Right.
Because if you have GC, the shortest is stable.
That's right.
It's 2 base pairs.
That's right.
For AU, it's 4 base pairs.
That's right.
For mixed GC and AU, it's somewhere in between.
Yeah, that's right. Peter raised a good point, which is that, coming back to the question that you raised, just picking any length is not really the right way to do it, because as you said, short lengths of high GC content are going to be as stable or more stable than longer ones of AU content. And so really what you'd want to do is, you could in fact go and put, you know, energies on these based on some of the thermodynamics that existed at the time this paper came out. In fact, this paper included a description of some methods for predicting structure based on thermodynamic methods. I'm only bringing it up now to just point out the fact that the kind of thing that worked for tRNA wouldn't work for a molecule that's only 3 times longer, simply because the number of possible short helices explodes very rapidly with the length of the sequence. That's right. That's right. I think the minimum they used here, each one of these molecules has at least one stem of, well, this is 5. I think they usually have at least one stem of 4 or 5 long. And then they use that as sort of the core, and then they've tried to see what else they can zip. So what I originally said about looking at stems of three or longer, I think they didn't do that. They actually required that at least one of the stems be longer than that. Right. Right. Yep. Anyway, so that's just pointing out that making sort of a list of all the possible stems quickly gets you in trouble as you start looking at more and more molecules. On the other hand, there are molecules that are very large. So this is what's called the 16S ribosomal RNA. It's the main component of the small subunit of ribosomes. In E. coli, this is the E. coli sequence and structure. The nucleus, it's about 1,500 nucleotides long. And this structure is, in fact, quite accurate. Probably has very few errors in it, although it may be missing some things. The crystal structure has recently come out. I can't remember if all of these structures are verified, but I think they're pretty much verified from the crystal structure. But even without that, this has been accepted as the correct structure for this molecule for a number of years now. And the reason we know that is by applying the kinds of methods they did with tRNA. There are now, if you go to the DNA sequence databases, I haven't looked recently, but last time I looked, there were over 3,000 sequences from different species of this particular molecule, the 16S RNA molecule, and they all fold up into more or less the same structure. Now, it turns out in some genera of the phylogenetic tree, they might be missing an entire domain. They might be missing that, for instance, or they might be missing that, or they might have something elaborated. In fact, the eukaryotic ribosomal RNAs are about 50% bigger than this, and they end up having additional structures stuck on. But nonetheless, they all have a common core, which is presumed to be the part that's really essential for function and has been maintained throughout evolution and exists essentially in all the sequences that have been done. So this is for the 16S, you get a similar picture for the 23S. This only shows you half of the picture. The molecule is about twice as big. And what's shown on here are parts of the structure that have been quote verified, and I'll describe what I mean by that in a minute. They're really quite reliable. On the other hand, you'll see a lot of single-stranded, you know, big loops with lots of single strands, and those are probably not really single-stranded. That is what I think is that, and I think most people would agree, is that what's shown here is probably correct, has very few errors, but it's probably incomplete. There's probably more of the structure that we don't yet know. And about how many stems are there? I don't know what you want to know. I mean, you could count the number of stems that are on here. Oh, it's called, sorry, the name 16S is the S is the sedimentation velocity in a sucrose gradient. This goes back to the 1960s when people were trying to describe the size of molecules, right? That was the best way they had to describe them. Remember, because ribosomes have been known since the 50s and 60s. So there's the 50S particle and there's the 30S particle, and that describes how fast they sediment. And so the sedimentation velocity is proportional to what? The log of the size of the molecule, essentially. Yeah, so that's where those names, whenever you hear S, what's called tRNA used to be called 4S RNA or 4.5S RNA or something based on its size in a fraction, in a sedimentation thing.
Uh-huh.
They seem to act like a ball, like a sphere.
Ball.
Yeah.
But is super exciting, like a good solvent or a bad solvent? Do you know if it's compact or fractal?
I don't know the answer to that. People don't use those methods anymore. Like I said, these were numbers that were generated in the 50s and 60s. The names have stuck ever since then. But in fact, what I call the 16S RNA here, if you take its real size, so 16S I think comes from the E. coli size. If you were to take that same molecule from different species, its size in sucrose might be anywhere from 13S up to 19S in terms of its sedimentation velocity. And if you actually count it in nucleotides, the E. coli one is 1,500 nucleotides. The smallest known ones are only 900 or 1,000 nucleotides, something like that, some of the mitochondrial ones. And they get up bigger than about 2,500 nucleotides. Okay. So their size range quite a bit. I can't answer your question. I don't know anything about the behavior. I mean, they treated them in the early days as if they were just spheres, and they, from that they calculated an approximate molecular weight.
Sedimentation was one of the very few methods how you could characterize a new molecule and how you could identify the impurities. So what they wanted to have is in sedimentation that they have a single band of the molecules, and the velocity of sedimentation gave the name sedimass, 3S.
Maybe I should point out that these methods, these sedimentation methods, even predate me, so that I've only learned about, it's not something I ever did, I've only learned about them historically, you know, by reading the literature. So I know where the names come from. But
since then, have people come back and characterized the actual size? If you treat it as a ball, have people given more careful measurements of the size of the structure? We know it's exactly how big.
Well, now, I mean, I don't know if they've ever done that for the RNA. Of course, usually they treat this just as part of the ribosome, and the ribosome itself, whether the 30S or the 50S, has been, I mean, you can see it in an EM, it's big enough, you can see it in an electron microscope. I don't know that that's been done. I don't know. Maybe Peter knows.
And what you can do is small angle X-ray spectrum, where you get more than just the size, you get shape parameters.
Right, right.
An expanded molecule, like a spherical molecule.
Yeah.
This has been done quite
extensively.
X-ray
is kind of hard to do.
Are there
cooler sort of measurements
than
just if I get the RNA?
Just yeah, when the molecule is larger, you can do light spectrum. Light spectrum gives you information of volumes, but for the smaller ones, like these,
smaller X-ray spectrum. Mm-hmm. Another way to phrase the question was the effective rating of scale.
Well, I would say approximately, but I don't know how good an approximation that is. It's treated that way, and it pretty much is. And now that there's a crystal structure out, of course, that's the whole ribosome with the proteins and everything, and it's not exactly a sphere, but you know, it more or less conforms that shape. It's certainly not elongated like a cigar. I mean, they knew that from fairly early on. Nowadays, I mean, people still do sedimentation for some experiments. For most kinds of things where you're trying to estimate a size, you'll use a gel fractionation method or something like that, which is easier and gives you the kind of numbers people care about.
Far away from random coil. If you do a random coil estimate of a molecule of that type, much more.
Random branch.
Random coil is very much.
Actually,
you might want to know the effective size or whether it depends on, well, how it would depend on whether it's a monovalent triangle or divalent. Is there information available?
Yes. If you have the compact form, it doesn't change very much. It changes conformation when you put the bag in.
Again, before I get into the sort of the basic method I want to describe, let me just point out, and I think a figure similar to this was actually shown last week, there are just different ways to represent RNA structure, and these are three different representations that are all equivalent to each other. So here's a classic tRNA drawn as this cloverleaf. I can make the same representation by just connecting the base pairs with arcs, as is shown in this line right here. Or, and this is the representation I was showing you before, where you imagine the sequence running along both sides of this thing, and I would just put a dot. And so if I had many, I'd put a dot at everything that base pair. So a helix like this would represent a line where I have the first few nucleotides are paired with the last few nucleotides, and then I have the three different clover leaves. So the reason I bring this up is just that different people, and even myself during the course of this talk, will use different representations to make to show you what the structure of an RNA is, because different representations make different points more easily. Okay, most biologists like to think about it like this because they can actually imagine how it's all folded up and stuff. But for a lot of reasons, these kinds of representations are actually simpler to deal with. And I just want to point out one other thing, which is, I think this was mentioned. So mostly what people talk about in the secondary structure is they're showing you the base paired regions, which nucleotides are paired with each other, and so on. There is a, and can be represented in the way I just showed you a second ago, but a common thing, or something that you'll hear about a few different times, is a so-called pseudo-knot structure. And I just want to define what that is because it has a mathematical definition. So this would be, this is a so-called planar folding, and this is a pseudo-knot folding. In this, in these two structures, they don't look that much different, but you can see the difference is, and this is the mathematical definition, a pseudo-knot is where any of these arcs cross each other. And the reason that that's important is that a lot of the methods for predicting RNA structure basically exclude this, because by excluding it, you can come up with a very simple dynamic programming algorithm that's guaranteed to give you the optimum structure under the constraints that you don't allow for these kinds of structures to exist. And that's, you know, and for the most part, people have ignored these kinds of structures simply for computational ease. And they justify that based on the fact that pretty much most of the structures that we know a lot about have very few pseudo-knots. Now, they don't have zero. In fact, every molecule I know of that's of a reasonable size, when they've actually determined its real structure, it contains pseudo-knots. This structure right here for ribosomal RNA has three pseudo-knots. There's this one here. This one here is not quite so obvious, and there's that one there. That is, if I were to draw this in the circle form, you would see that the arcs had to cross in order to make some of those base pairs. So pseudo-knots exist, they're real, they're in fact important in many of these molecules, but they're also relatively rare, at least as far as we know. And so in general, a lot of the structure algorithms that people use simply discount them with the hope that after you initially determine what the overall secondary structure is, and then you can figure out the pseudo-knots at a secondary step. Yeah?
Could it be that they seem to be rare in the algorithm, just the algorithm?
Yeah. You could argue that might be true, but this is a molecule where, as I said, I think we know its structure pretty well. Although the crystal structures come out, I'm not sure it's yet in enough detail at a small enough resolution, high enough resolution, that we really know what all the interactions are. But for the most part, most of the interactions are these secondary things, and then there are a few scattered about. And I think that's been true of every molecule that's been studied in enough detail. So you have to worry about what you raise, that maybe they're rare simply because we don't know how to find them. But I think that's not right. I think they really are relatively rare compared to standard secondary structure. I should point out again, this partly raises, this molecule right here has a pseudo-knot, but it could have either of two helices. So a pseudo-knot is only defined in the sense that you have a conjunction of two helices. I could leave that one out and I would just have a helix, or I could leave that one out and I would just have a helix. So it's really the conjunction of two different helices in terms of how the lines cross. So in other words, it becomes a little bit arbitrary if I put back this structure here, whether I consider this to be the pseudo-knot, or if I could form that as a base pair, and then I would consider the other thing to be the pseudo-knot. I think I'll skip that. So the method I'm going to talk about, it relies on an alignment in order to try to predict the structure. And in fact, as I described the method in its sort of simplest form and the way it's been most often used, people ignore the tree. They take an alignment, which they've obtained in some way they think is trustworthy, and from that alignment, they try to predict the structure. My point in showing you this slide right here is actually these three things are all intimately related. The structure, if you knew the structure, that you can actually use that to inform you about the alignment. The tree actually gives you information about the alignment and about the structure. And the ideal situation is you'd have a single algorithm that would solve all of these problems simultaneously. There's an algorithm by Sankoff that's about 15 years old now that will, in fact, you know, given some metric, will find the optimum alignment, structure, and tree to relate a set of RNA sequences. The problem with that algorithm is if I have n sequences of length L, the complexity is L to the 6n, right? So you can apply it for two or three sequences and that's it. So while it would be nice to be able to solve all of those problems simultaneously, typically what people do is they iterate. And that's what I'm going to talk about today mostly. Starting with an alignment, try to use that alignment to predict the structure. As I said, that's sort of the standard method that's been around for a while, and that would be what I call the comparative method. If we bring the tree to bear on the same problem, then I'll call that the phylogenetic method, because we're really taking phylogenetic information along with the alignment information to predict the structure. And then I don't know if I'll get to it today or not, but then what you'd like to do is, once you know that structure, or you've iterated a round of the structure, you go back and maybe refine what the alignment is based on that information, and also go back and refine what the tree is and sort of iterate that procedure until convergence. Okay, so here's the basic idea. As I said, originally this was solved on tRNA, really with only two sequences, but in a more general term, the way one would do it now is you would take a set of tRNAs and you align them. And I'm not going to talk about the alignment method. The alignment methods that are used are things that you've heard about already, by and large. Except there usually is this iterative thing where you know they have a common structure. So if you had an initial alignment which was just based on sequence, you could use that to help predict the structure. And you might go back and refine the alignment. And that's been done in this case. The point of this picture is just that if I have a set of tRNA molecules and I line them up like this, what you'll see is that even though the sequences are highly variable, if I look down almost any column of this alignment, is it clear what I'm representing here? Each line across is a particular sequence, and so there are a whole bunch of, see, these are different tRNAs actually from a couple of different species. So each column represents a position that's been determined to be homologous, that is aligned with each other. If I look at, so for instance, this GCTC right here is complementary to the GAGC here. That is, these four nucleotides are always complementary to those four nucleotides, even though these nucleotides themselves are highly variable. Okay? So the concept is quite simple, right? I'm just looking really for positions that when I change this position, it seems to have some influence and it changed some other position. That is, they co-vary. And in fact, originally that's the way it was done. That's the way the ribosomal RNA was solved, was they made sort of a crude alignment initially, and they look for positions that co-varied, and they say, well, these must be base paired. Let's assume that they are base paired. Let's make a little structure, and then from that we might go back and readjust the alignment. And that whole methodology started in about 1980, or actually slightly before that. And within a few years, they had determined a structure that's very similar to what we now know as essentially correct. So let me just define the way, so in order to apply this in a sort of systematic way, you need some measure of what you mean by correlation or covariation, and a variety of things have been used over the years. the method that we've used and other people have used is mutual information, and I'm sure many of you are probably familiar with this. Let me just define it. So if I have two positions in my alignment, remember going back to this RNA molecule, X and Y here would be columns in the alignment. What I want to know is, are positions X and Y independent of each other? If they were independent, then essentially the frequency at which I observe bases at X and Y, so this would be, in other words, of all the possible combinations, there are 16 combinations of a base at position X and a base at position Y. Those combinations that I observe would simply be or close to the what I would expect, assuming independence, right? By taking whatever the frequencies I had at position X and multiplying by the frequencies at position Y. Mutual information is a measure of the deviation from that expected value. So, right, everybody familiar with this? Relative entropy. So I have my expectation, my measured frequencies, dinucleotide frequencies up here, my expected values down here. So I'm taking a ratio of my observed to my expected frequencies multiplied by the observed frequencies. That's mutual information. I can rewrite it in this way, which is, people thinking about mutual information usually think of it this way. The entropy at position X plus the entropy at position Y minus the joint entropy at X and Y. And that will tend to zero if the positions are independent, especially as you get more and more data, it will tend to zero. And it will be non-zero if the positions are not independent. And in fact, writing it this way, it's, I guess, fairly easy to see that this is a log likelihood ratio statistic. In fact, I've got rid of the sample size here. I'm just dealing in terms of the frequencies. But if I multiply that by the sample size, n is my total number of sequences in my alignment, then it becomes a log likelihood ratio statistic. Should conform to a chi-square distribution. Yes, in this case, I and J are the alphabet. So I and J, of course, I would be ACG or T, and J would be ACG or T. And so if I take them together, I have all 16 combinations, A, 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 C, down to T, T, right? Unfortunately, the notation is gets messy and variable, and so if anything like that comes up that's confusing, remind me, because I'm sure since I've merged together slides from various talks, I'm not even consistent in my own notation. Okay. Sure. I mean, so one of the things, so part of the real RNA structure not only involves these pseudonauts and things which impose what are called tertiary structure, they impose sort of three-dimensional structure on something. There are other kinds of structure that come up. They're so-called base triples, where I can have a base pair and another base that sort of intercalates into the major groove and makes a contact with it and forms a base triple. I'm sure you're going to hear about that later in the week, because it's a common theme in when you actually do NMR or crystal structures about complete three-dimensional structure of things. And so the question is, could you identify things like that by looking at covariation of not just two positions at a time, but more than two? You can. Maybe I'll just talk about it briefly at the end about our own approach at that. The problem is you multiply the amount of data you need as you get more higher and higher levels of correlation. But you certainly can apply the same. You certainly can apply the same methodology to that problem. Yeah. So there have been a few predicted and then later verified examples of tertiary interactions obtained by that method, mostly in ribosomal RNA again, because there's so many RNA ribosomal RNA sequences. So Robin Goodell has and colleagues have predicted three or four tertiary interactions, I think at least some of which have been verified experimentally. Okay. How many do you need? It really, you can't answer that as a sort of a, just as a sample size question, because it depends on how variable the sequences are. If they're highly variable, then actually you can get away with fewer of them. But what happens is sometimes some of these positions, if I go back to the RNA, the tRNA thing, I said that most of the sequences are variable. There actually are some positions that are completely conserved, I believe. If I can find an example, or almost completely conserved. I think there's a T nucleotide, right? This nucleotide, well, it's not completely conserved. It's almost completely conserved as a T. There's a couple C's here. But there are some positions that are so highly conserved that if you see very little variation, it becomes very difficult to measure covariation. I mean, that it sort of sets up an underlying limit. So there isn't any hard and fast rule. There are other positions that are highly variable. They vary so rapidly that they apparently are unconstrained, except that they have to interact with another position. So one position is highly variable, the other position is highly variable. I can easily confirm that they base pair.
Gary, in this slide, you put all tRNA, no matter what they are.
That's right. This is a mixture. What's the letter over here corresponds to what amino acids they code for.
Now, if you would take tRNAs of different origin, mm-hmm. coding for the same amino acid, then you see the so-called discriminators, which are completely conserved.
That's right. That's right. That's right. There would be some things that were conserved because they all code for the same amino acid,
yes.
So you'd end up getting. Conservation in the anticodon, for instance, right? Well, this is a mixture of lots of tRNAs. It certainly isn't all tRNAs. When we wrote the paper where we described the method I'm going to tell you about in a second, there were 900 tRNA sequences or something like that in the database that we used in our analysis. So this is just a small fraction. Yeah.
There's some general insight on what's conserved, what's done. Here's an example where you have anticodon that's completely conserved. But if you look at the larger sort of
It's about 4 to 5 positions except the CCAN, which is completely conserved. So these are the so-called discriminations. What they are bound to the enzyme.
Right, but I think your question is more general, having to do with if I take a big molecule like this. So if I look at, forget about covariation, just take an alignment of these sequences and I ask in a column by column manner, what's the variability in terms of the amount of conservation? There are some positions that are completely conserved, even between yeast and bacteria and humans and everything, they're completely conserved. And so the assumption is, and in fact, again, at least in some cases these have been verified, is these are very critical to the overall function of the molecule. So for instance, the nucleotides that actually are part of, well, what's now believed to be part of the catalytic activity, which is actually performed by the RNA, those are completely conserved, as you'd expect. There are other positions that are very highly conserved. Then there are other ones that are highly variable. I mean, you essentially get an equal frequency of all possible bases or all possible 16 combinations of base pairs. Maybe I'll point out just a few interesting things about this. Some kinds of information that you get out of this covariance analysis that in fact would be difficult to predict by some other methods. It turns out there are actually some so-called non-canonical base pairs that are conserved. See, this isn't the best example. There are places where you actually can make GA base pairs. It's an unusual base pair. It actually has an unusual form in the backbone. It's not shown on this figure, but I think it's this one right here is actually predicted to be a real base pair. And the fact is that if you look at lots and lots of molecules, it either is GA or you can flip it over to AG, but it never switches to anything else. That is, it's variable, but it's variable within a very narrow confine. Where positions that completely don't matter. I don't know if this is true or not, but let's assume that this C down here just doesn't really matter for the function at all. Then you'll get an equal probability of ACG and U there if you look at all phylogeny. So you can get information about interesting constraints. Most of the time they conform to what you expect from Watson-Crick base pairs. But sometimes you get unusual constraints. That is, there are examples, I think, in here. I don't know where one is offhand, but there are examples where it's either a UU or a CC. And again, you can make base pairs between U's and between C's, and they have the same kind of overall structure. It's an unusual structure, but they're considered to be homologous structures. Well, some of these have been confirmed and some not. Actually, I meant to point this out as I started my talk, and I forgot. I brought with me a book called The RNA World that has a lot of interesting chapters about evolution, all kinds of stuff. One of the really good things about it, actually, is in the back it has some diagrams. And these were actually put in the book here by Tinoco, who's going to be here later in the week, and so maybe he'll bring some pictures along about unusual RNA structures. And furthermore, these are in stereo, and I brought my little stereo viewer along. So if you actually want to look at some interesting RNA structures, I mean, interesting loops, interesting non-canonical base pairs, and what they do to the overall structure of the helix, there are several examples in this book, and I'll just keep it in my office if anybody wants to come by and borrow it. And like I said, hopefully, maybe Tinoco or one of the other people who's coming later in the week will actually have pictures, and you can all put on your stereo glasses and look at pictures. Because actually, looking at them in 3D gives you a much more intimate view of exactly what's going on in terms of these structures. The most of the things that I'm focusing on right here, which are the helixes, are in fact quite boring. I mean, it's just, you know, it's base pairs and they're in a helix, and you know, you sort of look at one and they're all the same. But then there are these really interesting structures in which you have a bulge nucleotide or an unusual base pair, or certain ones of these loops out here have very interesting structures. And for the most part, you don't get that out of the kind of information I'm going to talk about today. That's another level higher, although we'd like to be able to get at that kind of information from sequence analysis. There was a question, I thought. Oh, several questions.
So if you put structural information or mechanical information in your study with the base pairing, because, you know, you could imagine mathematically making sequences where, say, you have a hexagonal array of lines coming up and they alternate between A, B, and C, you know, between the six things. So, you know, I can imagine that mathematical sequences of pairing would have done that, but I think that mechanical properties of the molecule prevent that.
Yeah, probably. I have never run across anything like that in the literature. And we don't do anything like that ourselves. I don't know of anybody who has.
But for example, the pseudonauts you talk about, that's going to cause the base pair on one end to rotate the miss to the other side. So there's some twisting of the bond.
Well, actually, no, because you bring up an interesting point. And that's actually, there's an example of a three-dimensional structure of a pseudonaut in here. And what's not clear in this picture that I showed is that, in fact, so it's written like this, and it looks like it's sort of funny. Actually, you can take this stem region here. So stem just means stacked base pairs. And you can take this stem, and they sit right on top of each other. And you end up with a contiguous stack. And what happens is these two loops right here essentially wrap around the molecule. But it ends up as a contiguous helix. If you isolated just that part of the molecule and looked at it by itself, you couldn't tell the difference between that and just a normal, everyday long stem. So it doesn't come up at all in these planar drawings, but if you actually look at it in 3D or try to model it in 3D, which we have done a little bit of, they end up nice coaxially stacked nucleotides. What happens is that this nucleotide here is the one that sort of gets pushed out of the way and it bends around.
So that argument would rule out, say, bringing another one
in. I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, what's shown here as this loop actually does come out of the board.
Yeah, the whole thing is here, but if I drew another line, say I took the bottom free end, brought it up, ran it parallel to the vertical line coming out of the board, connected somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
That would presumably be difficult to accommodate.
Maybe, although there are a lot of things that I thought would be difficult to do that people have actually shown you can do. You should read some papers by a guy named Ned Seaman, who's actually used RNA, mostly DNA molecules, but put them together in really interesting ways to make three-dimensional lattices, because they can hybridize in certain ways, and you can define very structured three-dimensional lattices of nucleic acid. It's really actually interesting work, and I don't know exactly what applications he's thinking about it, but you could imagine different kinds of applications where you can embed, because of the three-dimensional lattice, if I make different cells in the lattice have different properties, I could imagine putting in different ions and so on within the overall lattice. So look up papers by Ned Seaman, because I think they're really interesting, and I think they relate to at least the best thing I've seen that sort of tries to explore the potential three-dimensional structures that one can get out of nucleic acids. Oh, sorry, I had some what? Yeah. So I wasn't going to talk about how this alignment came about. I mean, you could have, the way people would do it is they would start off just doing sequence alignment, forgetting the structure. They would do a sequence alignment, and the gaps might end up here or they might not. Then they would sort of look at it and they would say, oh, these positions here are mostly complementary to these ones over here. If I add a few gaps here and there, I can actually readjust it to make it even better. And you know, it would give me even more structure. And so, in fact, this particular alignment, I think, had a little bit of manual manipulation based on it to optimize the structure. Now, there are ways to do it. Well, if you have a few misplaced things, if I could throw in one or even a small number of completely random sequences in here, and as long as my signal, my mutual information, stood up above background, I would still get the structure right. It doesn't have to be perfect in every case, but you're right. I mean, if there are misaligned things, if I have gaps in the wrong places occasionally, I'm adding noise to my signal. And if, as long as I don't add too much noise, I can still pick it out. So these are often done by iterative methods. I realized actually on the way here, Terry, that originally in our plan we were going to have somebody talk about stochastic context-free grammars, but I think there's no one left on the schedule who's doing that, right? I thought I might, maybe I should do that. Hidden Markov models were presented last week. Okay. Well, so let me just say this, and you can find books on it, and I could. It's not a field that I've worked on a lot myself, but I sort of understand the principles behind it. Hidden Markov models are this way, where you have states, and there's this EM algorithm that basically will give you a maximum likelihood alignment of all the sequences. There's an extension of that called stochastic context-free grammars, which does the same thing, but allowing for base pairing. That's where the context-free grammar part comes into it, right? And so there's a method where actually you could take, and there's a very nice paper by Eddy and Durbin, where they took tRNAs like this. They started with a completely random alignment, and by going through this iterative procedure, all no manual intervention at all, using this stochastic context-free grammar approach, which is, like I said, it's like hidden Markov models except allowing base pairing constraints. And they essentially generated, in the end, the correct alignment of all the tRNAs completely automatically by this optimization procedure, iterative optimization procedure. Okay? So that's all I'm going to say about the alignment. We're taking the alignment as given here, but clearly, if I could make an estimate of an alignment, and then from that make an estimate of the structure, and then I might want to go back and re-estimate the alignment based on my current estimate of what the structure is. That's why in that one figure I had the arrows going both ways. What I'm showing you now is given the alignment going to the structure, but you can also go from the structure back to predicting new alignments. The way it's most often used, if you gave me a new sequence, I could tell you the best alignment of that sequence with a given model for the structure. So anyway, this is a plot of mutual information on the z-axis. So the x and y-axis here are the same as before. But this is the same graph as this one, except drawn now as a contour plot, like you were looking at, you know, mountains and valleys and stuff in a topo map, right? And so the z-axis is the measure of the mutual information. and the x and y axis are the pairs of positions. Okay, so this is on the tRNA alignment. In fact, the cloverleaf structure just jumped right out at you. Not surprisingly, I mean, this was the alignment that I started with is quite a good alignment, and I showed you already that there's a lot of variation, and so there's a lot of covariation, and so it's not surprising that mutual information gives this. It turns out, though, actually, that some of these little peaks down here, some of these are just noise, but in fact, some of these actually correspond to some of these tertiary interactions I was talking about. So there is a little bit of a signal there, and the real issue is, can you sort of amplify that signal enough that you can learn something about tertiary interactions just from the sequence alignments? These peaks are all very sharp. Well, that you might lose it altogether. I mean, if I have a peak that's at a certain position, if the true alignment gave me a peak right here, and I spread that over a couple positions, it might just sort of vary, or it's actually possible to lose it altogether. It might end up showing no information. It's hard to predict what would happen in any particular case. So, of course, this information right here, this mutual information graph, doesn't actually tell you the structure per se. It shows you peaks, it shows you positions that are highly correlated, but then to actually go from that and predict what the structure is, you need some kind of algorithm, and this is actually the basis of that Eddy and Durbin algorithm. So there's a simple dynamic programming algorithm that will take this mutual information value matrix and generate the two-dimensional, the planar structure with maximum score mutual information. So it leaves out pseudo-knotted information, but it gives you the essentially follow the path. This is the stochastic context-free grammar method. Again, I wasn't going to go into details about it, but just point out that that this picture, which is kind of a pretty picture, and you can look at it and you can get a lot of information on it, but it doesn't actually give you the structure. You still have to apply some kind of algorithm to predict what the actual structure is. Yeah?
Yeah, I have a question about biology. From your lecture a couple of weeks ago, the tRNA basically just has two business ends, right? One end to grab onto the codons, and the other end for the amino acid.
Right.
Why does biology care about the structure?
So why is the structure conserved elsewhere? So the other thing is that all of the tRNAs have a number of things that they have to all do in common. They all have to bind onto the ribosome somehow. They don't hang onto the ribosome just by the codon-anticodon interaction. Actually, the tRNA fits into a pocket. And again, with the crystal structure, we'll know more about that soon. And so that's the rationale for why they all have the same structure. They all have to fit into essentially the same pocket on the ribosome. They also interact with a number of proteins. There are so-called translation elongation factors that take the tRNA once it's charged. So they won't grab onto a tRNA unless it has an amino acid onto it. Once it has an amino acid onto it, they'll essentially allow that tRNA to bind to the ribosome. And there are other factors of a similar type. And so, in fact, it interacts. Even though there are two important business ends, the amino acid at one end and the anticodon at the other, it gives you the genetic code. The tRNA itself has to interact with lots of other components in the cell, and that presumably is the reason that it's constrained to have a particular structure. Although the sequence doesn't seem to matter much, because most parts of the sequence are highly variable. There are a few parts that are sort of conserved, and interestingly, some of the most conserved parts are in the loops. The number of the nucleotides in here are conserved, and there's this other loop over here called the one where the TCGA is almost completely conserved in all these things. And so in many cases, it's the single-stranded regions that give you the most information for binding to proteins, more so than the secondary structure. The secondary structure is conserved simply so that it has the overall same shape, but it's the single-stranded nucleotides that the proteins can grab onto and confer the most information. Yeah.
T at the end of the terminal state is completely conserved. You go to the first stack.
The first stack.
This one, after this stack, there is a T.
Oh, I see. There's a T there. Okay. Yeah, so there are some nucleotides that are highly conserved, and presumably those have to do with not only is the structure conserved because it has to interact with lots of different things, and all tRNAs have to interact with the ribosome in the same way, but there are also a number of nucleotides that are absolutely conserved, or very close to absolutely conserved.
So that's exactly the kind of higher order details that you omitted a couple weeks ago.
Right. Okay, so It took me more than 10 minutes, but yeah, I gave you the basic idea of what the comparative method does. That is basically, and I've assumed that we already know the alignment. In general, you wouldn't know the alignment to start with, but you could sort of iterate through this procedure. But basically, you have an alignment, you now have a bunch of positions, and you ask which positions are correlated. And so if what I've numbered here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, they represent sequences, different columns. They don't necessarily have to be consecutive, like, but they represent columns in a line set of sequences, all of these would have the same mutual information, because in every case I can make a GC pair, and so they would have, you know, essentially one bit of mutual information for positions 1 and 2, the same one bit for 3 and 4. These would all have the same measure of mutual information. But if I also knew the phylogenetic tree, and this, let's say the tree looked like this, what it's telling me is that this sequence here, again, I'm just showing you a little bit of the sequence, but whatever sequence this came from, and this sequence were closely related species. You know, maybe they're two bacteria that are almost identical to each other, or they're humans and chimpanzees or something. So in that case, I'm not too surprised that that these positions are the same, because you notice that here, in fact, the positions are in fact identical. They're not changing very rapidly. On the evolutionary tree, in fact, there's only been I can explain all of the data in this column by a single mutation that separates all the C's from all the G's somewhere way back a long time ago in evolution. The same thing here. Whereas in positions 3 and 4, I've had multiple mutations that have had to occur. And at this positions 5 and 6, I've had lots of mutations. So each position is, in fact, when looked at on the evolutionary tree, has undergone lots and lots of mutations. But every time it's mutated, this position is also mutated along with it. Okay, so by ignoring the tree, I would say those positions all give me the same amount of information about structure. But as soon as I impose the tree on it, what I see is there, I should have some other value, which I've just called M prime here, some different measure of mutual information that takes into account the tree that tells me I'm really much more confident that positions 5 and 6 are base paired with each other, because they actually have undergone lots of changes through the evolutionary process and still maintain complementarity. Whereas these two positions, they may be paired or they may not. I really don't have very much information, because I can explain the data in those two columns by a single, well, one mutation in each of those two positions. The other information I need is I have to have some way of generating, knowing what this tree is. But I'm not understanding.
I was wondering why you put the tree like that, and why you don't put the piece of the 5-6 to all the classification.
Well, so that means I have to have, right, I could have rearranged these sequences in a different order such that all the C's and 5 were together and all the G's here. But what I've done is I've specifically put them in an order corresponding to the tree. So that assumes that I know something. I know that these are both bacteria, for instance, and I know that these two species are both mammals, and so on. In other words, what I'm showing you here is that I have additional information, independent information. This tree is not based on these sequences. That's the point, I guess, I need to make. This is independent information that tells me, you know, where these species came from. And using this information, I want to come up with a new measure of mutual information or something like it that will give me a better measure of the confidence I have that positions are paired. Okay, let me show you a simulation study. This was done by Alan Lapides. So this is what he tested. Let's suppose, because the way that I originally described the mutual information measure, the comparative method, it assumes there is no phylogenetic tree. It assumes that all the sequences are just simply independent events of a sequence that has the same structure and function. So you could think of that as a star phylogeny. There was some common ancestor back here, or they might even not be related, but they've simply been constrained to have the same structure. The way that he did it was he started with a single sequence, and then he just introduced mutations at a certain rate, and he generated, I forget the total number of sequences, 100 sequences or something, but where every sequence is evolving independently of every other sequence. And then he did the same thing where the total number of mutations from the tree, from the root to the leaves, is the same as it is here. But now you start off with one sequence, it divides into 2, and then from this, that divides into 4, and so on. So you have a nice process where, in fact, this sequence is very similar to that sequence. It's the distance in terms of the number of changes between this sequence and the ones over in this half are the same as you get in the tree here, but to the other sequences in this half, there's a whole hierarchy. It's close to some, it's intermediate to others, and it's far to the others. So the question is, what effect does this have on the measure of mutual information? So this is simulated data, which you build your phylogenetic trees, you put in a mutation rate, you just let the sequences evolve on the computer, you repeat it, you know, thousands of times, so you get lots of data, and you measure the mutual information. Now, the other thing I need to point out is that this is done on data where the positions are not interacting with each other. All the positions are independent. So this is a measure of what the background would look like. And in fact, so this is the measure of mutual information you get if the tree that you've done your simulation on is a star phylogeny. You get, you know, a nice, I don't know if it's a normal distribution or not, but it's a nice sort of smooth-looking distribution. If I do the same thing now where I impose and plot it on the same scale based on the binary phylogenetic tree, I get a much broader distribution. The reason that this is of interest is, again, when people have applied these comparative methods, if they ignore the tree, they're essentially assuming that their distribution looks like this. And so they might say, okay, I rarely see a value above 0.8, and therefore anything that's higher than that is statistically significant, right? Well, clearly things that are above 0.8 are not statistically significant. I guess another way to phrase it is that the structure of the phylogenetic tree, it imposes or gives you artifactual mutual information, which is not due to structure. It's an artifact of the fact that the sequences are evolving down a tree, not independently of each other. This was based on 1-0. These are binary.
There's no structure
at all. So I have 100 positions, and each position is evolving independently of every other position, and I'm just measuring the mutual information. So I get some mutual information just by chance. I mean, mutual information is always non-negative, so it's going to give me some value just by chance, and so this is the value. This is the distribution I would get of non-interacting positions when the phylogeny is a star, and this is the mutual information I get when I have non-interacting positions when the phylogeny is one of these binary trees. Haven't done that. I mean, he's done some more models like that more recently, but I don't have a graph for it. Why is it asymmetric? I think it's asymmetric because if for every, let's suppose that this is a complete binary tree, and I can't remember exactly how he did it, but let's suppose that at the bottom I have 64 leaves, so that meant I had six bifurcations in the tree, right? I had 64 leaves down here. If I count, every sequence has one other sequence that it's only two steps away from, and if each step from a sequence to the node up here is one step, in other words, 1% evolution or whatever, then every sequence has one sequence that's two steps away from it. It has two sequences that are four steps away from it. It has, I guess, eight sequences that are, you know, it's a progression where there are half of the sequences are in the other half of the tree. So half of the sequences are all the same 16 steps, just as they are would be up here. But there's a decreasing number of sequences that are at decreasing distances. And so I think that's what leads to the asymmetry.
Why is the star phylogeny set up like this? Is this some kind of straw man to be knocked down?
Yes.
Some creation?
Well, it's
creationist?
No, it's really based on the original comparative method says that these sequences all have the same structure and function. We're going to ignore so we assume that they have some common ancestor somewhere, but we ignore any structure in the phylogeny. That is, we're going to treat a human sequence and a mouse sequence the same as we would treat comparing a human and a bacteria. We're not going to care to the fact that the human and the mouse have only diverged 50 million years and the human and the bacteria have diverged by 3.5 billion. We're going to ignore that, right?
So I'm not surprised that it does poorly.
I'm not surprised that it does poorly either, but the point is that until we did this paper, which was actually just came out last year, although we did that work about 3 years ago, nobody had reported this kind of an effect. Everybody sort of knew it was true. And so, in fact, if you go back to the original literature where they would predict structures of things like this, they would make ad hoc rules. That is, they knew it was an important feature. They would make an ad hoc rule that, you know, I will consider a base pair proven if, you know, if one of these bases flips to something else, it changes from a G to an A, and the other one simultaneously flips from a from a C to a U. And furthermore, it's happened more than once in evolution. If it just happened once, I would say we won't trust it. But if it's happened at least twice, I'll trust it. So that was sort of an ad hoc rule of two or something. That helped make this more reliable. If you didn't impose that rule, you would get more spurious things. So we were just mostly trying to quantitate this value of, you want to include information from the phylogeny in your measure of mutual information. And I see that we're at tea time.
I don't think the alarms are related, but they're certainly correlated.
Right. Yes.
What is the information distribution?
What is the asymptotics of that distribution? You know, we never looked at it very carefully to see. I guess we could probably do it even analytically, since it's completely simulated data. And he knows how he set up the machine. We could probably do that. We never did it. Interesting question. Right. But since he imposed a completely binary tree with a fixed, constant distance between all the branching points, all that kind of stuff, we could impose, based on the evolutionary model, which basically gives you a rate of change per unit time, we could probably use that information to say what, we might have been able to predict, if we'd have thought about it enough, what this graph should look like, but we never did that. We just wanted to, mostly our point in this paper, this is a minor point in the overall paper, was that this curve and this curve are not the same, right? Because that had never been proven. So it's a fairly obvious thing once you do it, but we want to show that. And then in the rest of this paper, we talked about ways to get around this problem by including information.
Is there some experiment that you make the vertical axis so high?
I don't know why Alan did that. Yeah, it kind of looks funny that way, doesn't it? I agree. Bring that up with Alan when he comes and visits. I don't know why he graphed it that way.
If you look at experimental data, does it also show the same asymmetry?
Yes.
Because that's pretty successful.
Well, the problem with real experimental data, real data, is there are lots of other things going on too. You don't have constant mutation rates at every position. So you get a lot of other things imposed on top of this. So the curves are not symmetric, but I don't know whether they're asymmetric in an interesting way or not.
Right, I mean, it goes against the cost, but can you then sort of back out the evolution rate, mutation rate from these?
Yes, I mean, that's where I'm going to go to, actually. That's what we're trying to do, is we're going to go back and estimate for each position what the mutation rates are, and then use that information. You can actually reformulate the mutual information problem in terms of a likelihood ratio statistic, where the likelihoods actually come from the mutation model that you get by looking at the individual columns. That's exactly where I'm going. Thank you all very much. he just finished my seminar. So we should take a break for tea, and then, I have a little bit... I'm more than halfway done, but